everyday life, and it became routine, and you can never take it for granted because it is so incredibly unique here.
You know, you talked about, and we've got to get to it right now, because you said you were there with Bo. And, you know, talk to us a little bit about that day when, you know, Bo passed away.
You know, gladly. And I really haven't told a story, so I might as well tell it now as I'm walking out the door. And largely, I saved much of this because it was so personal. But what ended up happening is this. He came in. Obviously, he'd had some heart issues a couple weeks prior to the day that he passed away. And he had been in our studios previously, and the EMTs had to be called and everything else, and he was on the shelf for a bit. But he had gotten himself back. And you remember, Bruce, you had trotted him out to the podium earlier in that week, and he answered a bunch of questions about the game. So he really seemed, you know, filled with vigor and alive, and it was neat to see. He kind of thrived in that environment. And you remember that documentary that was done
right
about the game. Someone got that great shot of him sitting in Michigan Stadium. I mean, who would have known how poetic that shot would be of Bo looking over the field for what turned out to be that final time. But he showed up that Friday morning, and I had just been to a college reunion in Boston a couple of weeks before. So, you know, he'd come in on Friday mornings, and we would laugh and tell stories and have a great time, and everyone was so excited about that weekend and what was in store. And I was actually going to Columbus, so I was there early to be able to hop in the truck. And I was telling him some stories about the college reunion I just had in Boston. I showed him some pictures of my daughter, who was very young at the time. And I honestly believe the last thing he ever said, he looked at me and he gave me back the picture of Dahlia, and he goes, "You just be careful down there in Columbus. You stay on the fray. That girl needs a father." And just like that, you're laughing, I'm laughing, everybody's laughing, and we kind of break off and go our separate ways. And I went to the assignment desk, and then he walks to our locker room bathroom area, and I'm telling you, Bruce, Ira, no more than 90 seconds later, someone comes screaming out of the bathroom and says, "Call 911, Bo collapsed." And we're like, "Wait, what? What?" And all I saw was a stream of people coming out of the bathroom. And I looked at Don, because Don Chain was one of the people who was kind of running out of the bathroom at the time. I was like, "Who's with Bo?" And he said, "No one." And so I ran in there, and I knew that the photographer who was with me was certified in CPR. I knew that. So I said, "Get Dave." And so they got Dave, and I was the person who went into our locker room area there by the bathroom. And I was just holding Bo's hand, and I was holding his head. And he had hit his head, so he had a little cut on his head. And I grabbed his glasses, and I put his glasses in my shirt pocket. And Dave came running in. We started CPR. And you could tell. I mean, I don't know if you know the post report, but his internal defibrillator went off 18 times. I mean, the fact is, the man dropped dead. That's what happened. His heart gave out, he dropped dead. But we're doing everything we possibly could. And I don't know about you, I've never been in a life and death situation with anybody, let alone somebody like Bo Schembechler. So I'm sitting here over this man saying, "I cannot believe that this is happening right now, right here." And what do? You know, in those instances, you just got to step up and do the best you can. And Dave and I were there administering CPR as best we could. And we knew that the EMTs were coming. But in those instances, it seems like it's 20 minutes. From all accounts, it was less than five. But the guys came in, and I'm figuring, I'm going to get relieved, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And other people who were senior at our building were coming into the room, and they're like, no, Tom, just keep doing what you're doing. Like, just keep doing what I'm doing. The EMTs come in, and then we got to move them, and we get them out of the room. But they needed help as well. So I was kind of there through the whole process. And they got them on the stretcher. And at that point, they needed the phone number for Dr. Eagle. So Patrick McLaughlin was there, and he had Dr. Eagle's number. So the EMTs used my phone to call Dr. Eagle, and they got all the information they needed from him, the heart history and the neuropathy and everything else. And then, boom, he's off, and he's in the ambulance. And you can imagine how incredibly shaken everybody was. And so by all accounts, we thought that was it. We were praying for a miracle, but we're thinking, oh, my gosh, I can't believe we all just were a part of that. So now the responsibility becomes, I'm going to Columbus no matter what. So no matter what happens here as it relates to Bo, it's a story. I mean, let's hope he lives, but if he passes away, we needed somebody to be on the scene in Columbus to get the reaction from the other side, because we knew this would be a national story. So we, in the midst of all this emotion, have to hop in the live truck and start driving to Ohio. And so I'm with the guy who had done the CPR, Dave Meinhardt, and I, and we're, of course, listening to the radio, And my phone is blowing up, as you'd imagine, because everybody knows I work at Channel 7, and I'm ignoring all those phone calls because I don't know what's going on. And we're about halfway down, and our newsroom calls us, and they tell us that Bo had passed away. And never in my life have I experienced something like this with a coworker. The two of us pulled off to the side of the road and started bawling. It was unbelievable because we had been so close to it, and to hear it evolve and turn into a national story on the radio, and now all of a sudden be really far away from the story, because at this point we're a good 2.5 hours on the road away from the story that had just evolved, was a very surreal feeling. So we finally gather ourselves, and we're driving to Columbus, and I kind of hit my chest, and I was like, oh, my God, I still have his glasses. And I grabbed the glasses out of my pocket, and if you know Bo, and you guys both do, he wore cologne. So, like, I smelled of the man because I'd been cradling his head and I'd been holding his hand. So it was a very, very odd and surreal feeling. But the weekend went on as it went on, and that was the most emotional thing I ever experienced in my life, let alone anything I experienced here as it relates to Michigan. Kind of crazy, right?
Crazy. That story, Ira. Ira and I were looking at each other. We're in different studios, and we're looking at each other just, I mean, aghast. I mean, I have never heard that story, Dom. Never. And that had to, I mean, you know, it's interesting because Tom mentioned that he had a job to do as a reporter. And that's how I felt when I went to the hospital, that I had a job to do, because everybody said, Bruce, you were so composed. Everything was so, you know what job you have to do. But for you to have to do that job and to have just held him, and then to have what you said, the smell, the feel, the whole thing, I can't even imagine how that would be with anybody who had passed. And then you've got yourself, you know, a legendary coaching figure that you're going to have to do a story. That must have been the toughest day of your career.
It was incredible. I mean, have you ever in your career, in the middle of it all, with a colleague, just gone into a corner and cried? That's what we did. Dave and I, we couldn't continue. We needed to gather ourselves, and it had been so emotional that we just had to gather ourselves and compose. And as we pulled over into a rest stop, here we are in the Channel 7 truck at a rest stop and just bawling. And we knew that that's kind of how everybody associated with Michigan and who knew college football was going to feel that day. So I guess it was good that we got it out of our system early, because, again, we were able to shift it into gear. And the people at Ohio were great. You know, we talked to Gene Smith, and we talked to so many of the fans down there, and everybody was incredibly gracious. And then we had to be there when the team arrived. And I remember John Falk, oh, man, he shows up, and his lips were quivering. And he was, because the game was being played the next day,
right,
basically thrown out there as the person to give a thought. And the poor guy, you could tell he was devastated. So you can say what you want about how the team rallied the next day, but it had to affect how they prepared for that game. And the game still played out so incredibly close and competitive. They all deserve a ton of credit.
I'm trying to put myself in Tom's shoes. I went through journalism school, had choices as to what I wanted to do with my career. I got into sports. One of the reasons why was because you avoid, for the most part, life and death situations. The stories are, for the most part, they're fun, and it's games. And that's, I'm sure, one of the reasons that, Bruce, you're in the business. Tom, I'm sure that's one of the reasons you're in the business. We get to talk about games. And you have to go from talking about a game and in a pretty instant moment. We talk about sudden change in football. I mean, this is the ultimate sudden change in this profession that none of us really signed up for, but you have to do it when the job calls for it.
You're right, Ira. It's one of those things that you got to be prepared for. And I think one thing, Bruce, you mentioned as we started the conversation, I was able to quickly adapt to Detroit. And I think that just comes from research and understanding and basic knowledge of the history of this game. I thought it was so cool. You know, I watched the Fab Five and all the success of Michigan, even dating back to 89 in the basketball tournament. And because the East Coast didn't have major college football, yes, I went to Boston College, but Bruce, I'm sure you were there on the day that Desmond Howard came to BC and lit it up.
Yes.
I remember, you know, I was a student then at BC, and I remember walking towards the stadium and seeing Michigan's equipment truck. And on the side of the equipment truck were the stickers for all the different bowl games that Michigan had gone to over the years. And I said, we're not even in that universe. You know, that's not our reality. So I had embraced and I had kind of adopted Michigan growing up as my team because, like everybody else, or like many other people, I really enjoyed, I loved the helmets, and I loved the whole aura around the team. So, and for me, in the 80s, without a major college football team on the East Coast, I mean, obviously I rooted for Doug Flutie in BC, but Michigan was my team. So I was actually at the 89-90 Rose Bowl, which ended up being Bo's last game.
Yes.
So now combine those two stories. All right. So you're with Bo on the day he dies and the moments that he dies, and go back in time to January 1st, 1990, when that 17-year-old high school senior is in the Rose Bowl, sitting in the corner end zone section, and have a little angel tell that 17-year-old kid, oh, and by the way, when that coach dies, you're going to be with him. I mean, those are the moments in life that are always very odd to me. So you never know what might happen, and you got to be prepared for anything.
Tom, the story, absolutely wonderful. And now, I mean, for those people listening, I mean, now you know.